For WKU Public Radio, I'm Kevin Willis. The role of unions has been hotly debated in a number of state houses across the country this year. In places like Wisconsin, Indiana, and Ohio, some heated controversies have developed over the bargaining rights of public employee unions. The situation raises a number of questions about what role organized labor could play in the U.S. in the years ahead, and it creates an opportunity to look back at the history of organized labor in this country. Dan Modlin has this report.
Organized labor plays a key role in the production and delivery of many of the goods we depend on every day. Eldon Renault is the president of UAW Local 2164 at the Corvette Assembly Plant in Bowling Green.
I think that all workers have achieved a great deal because of the struggles that people have made on behalf of labor unions. From the very inception, unions got involved with social activism because we did have at least a group that thought the same way, that people should be entitled to a decent job so they can support their family in a way that they can maybe make the lives of their children better than theirs.
But how did organized labor develop in this country? Dr. Thea Browder is with the WKU History Department. She believes the Haymarket Riot in Chicago in 1886 helped to radicalize many people in the working class.
The way that it was spun, the sort of crackdown afterward, the trial of the accused anarchists and so forth, it had sort of a dual impact. And one thing it did was it allowed a lot of employers and a lot of conservatives to stir up, and nativists to stir up fear of immigrants and to tar any sort of collective efforts by workers with, you know, with the brush of being a foreign and illegal and suspicious ideology, when in fact there was lots of homegrown activism as well.
The United Mine Workers took a lead position in establishing collective bargaining. Founded in Columbus, Ohio in 1890, the UMWA was a merger of the Knights of Labor Trade Assembly No. 135 and the National Progressive Union of Miners and Mine Laborers. The union was intended as a three-pronged labor tool for mine safety, to improve miners' independence from owners and the company's store, and to provide collective bargaining power. The union worked for eight-hour days as far back as 1898. Once again, Dr. Thea Browder.
There were people who saw, and in a whole series of clashes in the late 19th century, people went in with sort of moderate views, and then when they saw the sort of the forces of law and order aligned against them, also private police forces hired by employers coming in and beating people up and in some instances killing people, I think it actually promoted a lot, you know, growth of a lot of more extreme political movements.
The Pullman strike in Chicago in the 1890s was another important confrontation over the rights of workers. UAW Local 2164 President Eldon Renault believes Eugene V. Debs became an important leader during those years.
Eugene Victor Debs from Terre Haute, Indiana, while he was a socialist, that's well known, he did believe that people should have the right to support themselves and have the right to bargain collectively. While we might not agree with all the things that he had in mind, he certainly gave his entire life to promoting the cause of all working people, whether they're union or non-union.
Dr. Browder says a highly publicized fatal factory fire also was an important turning point.
The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fired. There had been big efforts to unionize and, big strikes in 1909, 1910, just before the fire. And when the fire broke out, you know, as I said, it created all this political will. So for a while, it created these coalitions between, you know, in that case, New York Democrats and reformers, progressive reformers. In some cases, you know, groups of, you know, sort of, there was a group of wealthy elite women, too, who had followed it and who were, you know, outraged by the conditions that young women were working under, so forth. So in that sense, it created a lot of political will, and there was a sense of, you know, this shouldn't be happening in America. And so they passed, you know, like 35 different laws, you know, in New York State, and then that were copied around the nation in various places, and used some of those as a blueprint.
The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, which occurred in March of 1911 in New York City, claimed the lives of 146 garment workers. Many could not escape the burning building because exits had been blocked. Dr. Browder says some of the individuals who took steps to address the disaster later had an impact on the national level, people like Frances Perkins.
She had come up through a group called the National Consumers League, which is a group of women who were trying to use consumer pressure to do better workplace conditions. She was in New York State and ended up investigating working conditions after the Shirtwaist Fire. It was on that commission and ended up helping to push through laws in New York State. And then she went on to become the first female cabinet member and Secretary of Labor under Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal. So she was very important in that sense.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
Dr. Patty Minter, a legal historian at WKU, says the Great Depression served as a backdrop to some key developments in the labor movement. She says the concept of distributive justice drew more attention during the hard times of the Depression.
What happens with the Depression is a massive downshift of status. If you were very rich, you might be merely rich. Even John D. Rockefeller lost a third of his wealth. I mean, he wasn't starving. There were stockbrokers on Park Avenue in New York who had to move out of their mansions because they couldn't afford the help anymore. So that's not really, you know, if you're starving, then boo-hoo, you don't really care. But, you know, to those people, that is a downshift in their status. And if you were middle class, you might lose your house. And you might have a white-collar job and you get a blue-collar job. And if you're in the upper part of the working class and you have a skilled labor job that paid better wages than selling an apple, now you're selling an apple. So everyone found they were not immune to the downshift. And I think that opens the door for thinking about distributive justice, the idea that there needed to be a floor, there needed to be some minimum guarantees that if you worked hard, you weren't going to starve, that you could, you know, it was possible that you could work 7 days a week in a steel mill and your family could still starve in the Gilded Age. And distributive justice means that that would no longer happen.
Dr. Minter believes a key turning point occurred during the Depression when the Supreme Court ruled on the National Industrial Recovery Act, and she believes the stock market crash that preceded the Depression helped to create a different way of viewing many aspects of the economy.
The crash calls unregulated capitalism into question because it's very clear that a handful of people manipulated the market and there's no check on the system, and suddenly everybody is suffering. Even if you had nothing to do with it, your whole life is transformed. So it creates an environment where people think about the relationship of government and society to the citizens in just a completely different way.
Married life ain't hard. You're packing a union card. And a married man has a happy life if he's got a union wife. So you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union until the day I die.
Dr. Tony Harkins is the director of the Popular Studies Program at WKU and an associate professor of history. He says the Wagner Act, passed in 1935, helped to clear the way for the CIO to boost its membership.
Wagner Act is essential in that for the first time the federal government says workers have the right to unionize, to collective bargaining, and the federal government will be a mediator in negotiations and arbitration between unions and companies. And this had never been done at the federal level before. It was in the NRA Act, but that had been ruled unconstitutional, and this was a way to work around that. Once the Wagner Act is established, Congress of Industrial Organizations goes around and says basically the federal government wants you to join the union. So they use it very effectively to dramatically expand unionization.
There's no question that workers on assembly lines in U.S. auto plants have been key members of the labor movement in the United States. Dr. Harkins describes the origins of the United Auto Workers.
1937 in Flint, Michigan, and there was a wave of unionization at that time, and the auto industry had adamantly refused to allow non-company unions. So it was one of the most dramatic events in labor history. The workers took over the plant, and rather than pick it outside, simply took it over. And because the company was going to lose money if they shut it down because of the cost of restarting heating and everything else like that, they kind of used that against the company. The governor of Michigan refused to call out the National Guard and use them against workers, as had been done countless times. And so after 44 days, the company relented, and Ford and Chevrolet shortly there, General Motors shortly thereafter, and the UAW is born.
In their book, Modern Labor Economics, Robert Smith and Ronald Ehrenberg say unions can be classified into two types. An industrial union represents most or all of the workers in an industry or firm. A craft union, on the other hand, represents workers in a single occupational group, such as dock workers or printers. In recent months, controversies have emerged in several Midwestern states regarding the role public employee unions should be playing. Dr. Dan Myers is an economist who specializes in the study of labor economics. He points out some of the differences between the roles of public employee unions and those in private industry.
Public sector union membership is running about 36 or 37% in 2010. It's around 7%, or a little bit less, for private sectors. So it is much more prevalent today in the public sector than it is in the private sector, which has not always been the case.
Dr. Myers says since a significantly higher percentage of public employees are union members as opposed to private company employees, he believes those public employee unions could become increasingly significant in organized labor in the years ahead. And as NPR reported earlier this year, the role of public sector unions was drawn into question in several state general assemblies, including those in Midwestern states such as Ohio, Indiana, and Wisconsin.
All this week, workers have flocked to the Capitol in giant waves of protests. Today, they're outside at a rally on the Capitol lawn and picketing the streets on the Capitol Square.
Many union members think the governor is trying to bust their unions.
Dr. Brian Strau is the BB&T professor of the study of capitalism at Western Kentucky University. He says public sector unions have had some interesting supporters and detractors in the past.
Even FDR refused to let federal employees unionize. They were not unionized in the 30s. And his argument was, well, why do you need to be able to collectively bargain against taxpayers? We're not some mean employer who's trying to exploit people and make you work in hazardous working conditions. There's no need to collectively bargain against taxpayers. It wasn't until President Kennedy, was the first president to say, oh yeah, federal employees, you can unionize and bargain against taxpayers.
And Dr. Dan Myers predicts we will continue to hear controversy surrounding the roles of public sector unions in the years ahead.
Especially if you're in a right to work, in a state without right to work laws. Your politicians see this as a stream of contributions that go into the unions and therefore go to the other party. So it may be a way to deal with that.
In conclusion, there seems to be general agreement that organized labor has had an impact on the working conditions and standards of living for many workers, both union and non-union. But there are many different opinions about what role the labor movement should and could play in the future.
The evidence is absolutely clear that when you can bargain collectively, your wages are higher, your benefits are higher, the promise of having an old age in which you can have some level of security is absolutely better. And without unions that were empowered in the 1930s, there would be no private pension.
The unions were not necessarily benefiting the members of the union. So Congress passed laws that kind of protected the union members from the unions. So through time, it's been kind of an ebb and flow.
So you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union until the day I die.
Business owners say, well, I could open up a new plant here, but I don't want to face shutdowns, and so I'm going to move to a different state.
The negatives, I think, come from simply size and the bureaucratic nature of unions, and that's true of corporations as well.
We needed more government oversight and intervention, and eventually that workers needed to be able to bargain to counteract the employers who, you know, were just focused on profits.
We want to keep jobs in America for Americans.
unions, one of the big things they have been able to do is through the political process, force non-unionized employers to offer higher benefits. Now, who is that good for? Who's that bad for? Well, there's both.
You know, nobody in labor asked for a handout. They asked for a hand up.
Rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
This has been a special report of the Public Radio Service of Western Kentucky University. For WKU Public Radio, I'm Dan Modlin.